After 6 weeks in El Paso, his only diversion an occasional poker game in one of the saloons, Nathan was seriously considering moving on. True, Granny Boudlow had fussed over him and fed him an empty at any hour of the day or night they chose to eat, but the routine was getting to him. The stage from San Antonio came in twice a week, and Nathan was usually there for the newspapers from South Texas. He was half hoping there might be some word on King Fisher, but there was nothing. And when he eventually got some information, it was from a direct source. One of the passengers who stepped down from the stage was Molly Horrell.
Molly, what are you doing here?
I'm getting as far away from King Fisher and my damned ornery kin as I possibly can.
Well, it's near supper time. Let's go somewhere and eat, then we'll talk.
I doubt you'll want to hear anything I have to say.
Yes, I do. I like you, and I thought you were the best thing that ever happened to King Fisher.
Huh. I thought so, too. But I've learned better.
We'll talk after we eat. Aren't you hungry?
I'm starved. I had just enough money for stage fare.
That won't do. Where are you going from here?
I don't know. To hell, maybe. Isn't that where all the Horrells belong?
But I heard in Austin that you and King...
were married? Yeah, that's a lie King spread around, hoping to prevent my hell-raising kin from coming after me. I shared his bed, but not his life.
We'll save the rest of it until we've had some grub.
Where's your dog?
He's at Granny Boudlow's boarding house. She feeds him about 6 times a day, and he's taking to staying there when I come into town.
They found a cafe, and Nathan ordered steak for them both. Molly ate all of hers and half of Nathan's.
Oh, I'm ashamed of myself, but I've never been so hungry in my life.
Well, nothing to be ashamed of. You won't starve as long as I'm around.
Molly's head seemed hard as nails, but she had found a sympathetic ear, and the barriers began to fall. She soaked Nathan's shirt with her tears, and it was a while before she was able to talk.
Ben Thompson was the cause of it.
He's only temporary. He shows up maybe once a year, and you're rid of him for a while.
Oh, it wasn't just him. It's all been festering like a sore ever since King took me home with him. Thompson just brought it to a head. Nothing I wanted ever mattered. King still went to Uvalde or San Antonio on Friday, and I wouldn't see him until sometime Monday. He went right on drinking, gambling, and sleeping with other women as though I didn't exist.
But if you weren't with him, how can you be sure? I knew he drank and gambled, but in all the time I've known him, he didn't seem like a womanizer.
He told me. He kept telling me he was going to find him a woman that knew how to please a man, that didn't spend all her time whining about his habits.
So you can't go back?
It isn't so much I can't. I won't. I'll take a job in a whorehouse first. I already have the name, so why shouldn't I play the game?
Because you don't have to. I own half of Granny Boudlow's boarding house. And I want you to stay there and look after my half. She can use the help, and it'll be a home for you. There'll be money, too, because she's done well.
Why would you do this for me?
Because you're a good woman, and because I like you. That, and I'd say you saw King as a means of ridding yourself of the Horrells. I had hoped it might go deeper than that between you and him.
So did I. You know, I've been slapped around all my life, and King was the first man who was ever kind to me. I took that for something stronger, deeper. And if he had given just a little...
Come on, Molly. It's not far. We can ride double.
Reaching Granny Boudlow's, Nathan didn't mention King Fisher. Instead, he introduced Molly as an unfortunate who had fled San Antonio to escape the hell-raising Horrells.
So, if it's all right with you, Granny, I'd like for Molly to remain here with you, helping where she can.
Oh, he's good. Just like when you...
Granny caught herself just shy of mentioning Myra Haight's name.
Just like home.
Is home. No debt to the bank. We make money. Well, supper time.
We had a little something in town, Granny, but it's hard turning down one of your meals. Maybe we can hold some more.
It was more for Molly's sake than his own, and she didn't disappoint him. When the meal was finished, Granny led Molly to a room next to Nathan's, and he wondered if the old lady already knew something he didn't. Later, far into the night, he was sure of it. When Nathan opened the door to his room, Molly Horrell was there.
I can't sleep. The ghost won't leave me alone.
Nathan let her in. Come the dawn, she was still there. Dodge City, Kansas, March 15th, 1880. Harley and West took the eastbound to Kansas City. The following morning at 6, they would depart for Pueblo, Colorado. There'd be a military payroll bound for Fort Dodge, and after a turnaround in Pueblo, a shipment of gold ore back to Kansas City.
You're about to cut your teeth on a big one. On the way west, we're subject to being shot between here and Dodge, and on the way back, between Pueblo and Kansas City.
Well, the only thing I don't like is being locked in the baggage car. If we're hit, I can't be of much help to you. Can't we change that?
What have you got in mind?
If you're riding the caboose, why not have a boxcar at the far end of the baggage car behind the tender? I can ride the boxcar, where they won't be expecting me.
I think that can be arranged. From Kansas City, I'll telegraph Hagerman and Dodge.
The 6 a.m. westbound left on schedule. Harley riding the caboose and Wes concealed in a boxcar between the tender and the baggage car. The thieves stopped the train a few miles west of Wichita. Harley climbed atop the caboose with a Winchester as 6 of the outlaws reined up just out of range.
You on the caboose and anybody inside, leave your guns and step out with your hands up!
And if we don't?
We'll shoot the engineer and the fireman and dynamite the baggage car!
But when the train had begun slowing, West Tremaine had climbed through a hatch in the roof of the boxcar. Belly down, he made his way toward the tender, and by the time the 4 outlaws demanded the fireman and engineer step down, Wes was within range. It all depended on him. He cut down on him with his Colt. 2 of the outlaws dropped, all the break the train men needed. Seizing their weapons, the engineer and fireman gunned down the remaining 2 outlaws. Wes ran along the tops of the cars, reloading as he ran. Harley saw him coming and opened up with his Winchester. Realizing their comrades at the head of the train were down, the 6 outlaws ran for their horses. The brakeman stepped out of the caboose, firing after them with his Winchester, but they were out of range, mounting their horses.
They're gone! Let's get this train moving!
Reaching Wichita, the engineer backed the train onto a sidetrack and Harley sent a telegram to Kansas City, requesting a section crew to repair the track. While they waited, Harley and Wes went for coffee in a small cafe.
Wes, you came through when it counted most.
First time I ever shot a man. But there was no other way.
There never is when you're dealing with outlaws. They'll kill you if they must and not give it a thought. I aim to talk to Hagerman and see if we can't rid ourselves of that baggage car. It's as good as telling outlaws there's a payroll aboard. How many times did Nathan tell them to secure the payroll in the caboose in a bolted-down strongbox?
Who?
Nathan Stone. He got me on with the railroad after he left. My God, he was good. He once trailed a band of outlaws into Indian territory and only 2 of them escaped. Single-handed, he killed 11 men.
I'd like to meet him.
Well, eventually you will. When you do, he's not the kind of man you'll soon forget.
The section crew took a while repairing the track, and the westbound went on its way 4 hours behind schedule. Foster Hagerman was waiting for them when the train rolled into Dodge. Harley and Wes met him in his office.
You made a good choice. Wes gunned down 2 of the outlaws, while the engineer and fireman got 2 more. I just sat in the caboose and watched the rest of them ride for their lives.
Oh, from now on, I think we'll do what Nathan was forever suggesting. We'll bolt down that strongbox to the floor of the caboose and secure the payrolls there.
What about the boxcar behind the tender?
Oh, I think we'll keep that. It made a difference when the outlaws tried to take the engineer and fireman hostage.
Wes needs a rifle. Do you have a Winchester he can use until he can get one of his own?
Yes, and I'll see that he gets a new one, compliments of the railroad. Losing that payroll would have hurt us.
El Paso, Texas, April 1st, 1880. Nathan's relationship with Molly Harrell blossomed quickly and became so obvious that Nathan felt compelled to speak to Granny Boudlow.
Granny, I don't know how to say this, but Molly...
Molly need a man, and you a man. Why that bother you? Molly younger and more pretty than Myra was.
It bothers me for the same reason my arrangement with Myra bothered me. I'm a wanderer, needing to ride on, and I don't know when I'll be returning to El Paso.
You feel guilty. But why? She partners with me. She have home, food, and money. When you here, she have you. Bueno.
I only hope she sees it that way.
I talk to her. I need her. You want her? She wait.
Dodge City, Kansas, April 16th, 1880. It being Friday, Hagerman joined Harley, Wes, and Vic at Delmonico's for supper. They had just left the cafe when trouble started.
You! Saloon swamper! I told you we'd meet again! Nobody slaps Bert Savage around and goes on living! I'm inviting you to draw! Unless you've got a yellow stripe down your back!
Wes stepped off the boardwalk and stood there, waiting as his three companions got out of the line of fire.
When you're ready, scrub bucket.
Wes said nothing. Bert Savage tried to draw, but he was no match for Wes Tremaine.
Great shooting, Wes.
For the next 2 days, Wes was embarrassed beyond words as men slapped him on the back and insisted on shaking his hand. It was with considerable relief that he boarded the eastbound for Kansas City on Monday.
How long is this likely to go on?
Kid, it's just started. When word of it gets around, there'll be others, all wanting to prove they can beat you.
But why? I only defended myself.
That's how it always begins. And it'll go on as long as men try to look taller than they are by pulling a gun.
El Paso, Texas, May 1st, 1880. The longer Nathan remained in El Paso, the more difficult it became for him to leave. Molly's first night in his bed, to Granny Boudlow's amusement, became an unabashed nightly ritual. And if Molly Harrell ever thought of King Fisher, she concealed it well. On Monday, Nathan always took Granny Boudlow's money to the bank for deposit, and it was on such an occasion that he became involved in a holdup. He was about to present his deposit to the teller when the robbers made their presence known.
Down on the floor, all of you!
There were four of them, all with guns drawn. Nathan dropped to one knee. Before the others could overcome their surprise, he cut down a second man. Encouraged, one of the tellers opened fire, and the remaining two outlaws broke for the door. To Nathan's dismay, the rest of the bank's personnel and the customers who had seen his reaction gathered around him. And that's how it was when Sheriff McCormick arrived. He examined the two dead men and then set about asking questions of the bank's patrons and personnel. When he reached Nathan, there was admiration in his eyes.
That was a slick piece of work. Do you know who those men are?
No. I've never seen them before.
They're part of the Sandlin gang. They're wanted on both sides of the border, and there's bound to be a reward.
I don't want it. I have my own reasons for disliking bank robbers.
It's likely the Sandlin gang will be bent on revenge.
And what would you suggest that I do?
Was I you, I'd ride on. This bunch is dug in solid, wanted here and in Mexico. I hear there may be more than 24 of them. They got a regular border empire, with eyes and ears everywhere. And if they want you, they'll get you.
A week later, Nathan and Molly were just finishing dinner in Granny's boarding house. That was when the Sandlin gang hit. From outside, half a dozen Winchesters cut loose.
On the floor!
My God, what was that all about?
The Sandlin gang's after me. They're out to get even for the owl hoots I gunned down in the bank last week.
Granny came into the room. She'd been upstairs when the shooting happened.
You talked to Sheriff.
I have. He suggested I ride on.
No!
There's more than 24 of the varmints, and they're holed up on both sides of the border. You want a daily dose of what you had tonight?
Cost $100 fixed them windows.
If you go, I'm going with you.
Molly, there are men all over the frontier who would like to see me dead, and they'll kill anybody standing in their way. That includes you.
If you ride away, I may never see you again.
If I stay here and ride into El Paso, you may never see me again. I'll ride back when this settles down, but I don't aim to stay here where lead meant for me can kill you or Granny. Surely you can understand that.
I can understand your reasoning, but I don't like it.
He's smart, hombre. You listen.
Assured by Nathan that he would return, Molly made the best of it, and Nathan rode north the next morning at dawn. Oglala, Nebraska, June 26, 1880. Oglala proved to be a lively town stretched along the Union Pacific Railroad tracks. There was an abundance of saloons and boarding houses catering to railroad men, and again Nathan left empty behind while he visited the saloons. One of them, the Cementario, had a crimson death's head painted above the door. It was the rowdiest of the lot, and Nathan was surprised to find the house dealer was none other than the unpredictable Billy Thompson. Nathan bought a beer, leaned against the bar, and searched the crowd, fully expecting to see Ben Thompson. But this time, it seemed Billy was on his own, for Ben was nowhere in sight. Nathan moved closer, and it soon became obvious that Billy Thompson had continued his relationship with the bottle. He was just drunk enough to have unbounded confidence in himself, which proved to be his undoing. One of the men dropped his cards, slid his chair back, and stood up.
Billy Thompson! You're a cheating tin-horn bastard!
Damn you, Jim Tucker! Draw!
But Texan Jim Tucker had an edge, for he hadn't been drinking. Billy stumbled back and sat down in his chair, bleeding from five wounds. Sheriff Ollie Naylor came in and looked from Jim Tucker to the bleeding Billy Thompson. Despite his wounds, Billy still gripped his colt.
Even break, Sheriff. He was cheating.
Thompson was taken away, and there was angry talk as Jim Tucker spread out the cards from which Billy'd been dealing. Ben Thompson always seemed to be around when Billy got in over his head, but for once, it seemed Billy was on his own. Nathan found the doctor's office and went in. Since he considered himself a friend of Ben Thompson, he could at least telegraph Ben and tell him of Billy's predicament, if only he knew where Ben was. Nathan waited in the outer office until the doctor came out.
I'm Dr. Summers. What can I do for you?
I'm Nathan Stone, a friend of Ben Thompson, brother to the man that was brought over from the saloon. I reckon I can telegraph Ben if Billy knows where he is.
Billy Thompson is in no condition to talk to you. As soon as I'm finished with him, the sheriff is having him moved to the hotel under guard.
There was little Nathan could do except leave, and he did. Many a man on the frontier had been shot dead for cheating at cards, and it seemed Billy Thompson had been in town long enough to accumulate some enemies. While Nathan had no intention of taking on a lynch mob to save the troublesome Billy Thompson, he decided to remain in town another day or two. He still wasn't convinced that Ben wouldn't show up. The next afternoon, Nathan returned to the saloon where Billy Thompson had been shot, and to his surprise, he encountered Bat Masterson.
Been here long?
Couple of days. I was here when Billy Thompson was shot.
I heard about that. Let's find us a table and talk.
They took chairs at a corner table.
I am assuming Billy isn't dead. So where is he?
At the hotel. I would have telegraphed Ben, but I have no idea where he is. I've been warned to stay out of this by none other than Sheriff Naylor himself.
That's good advice. Ben's about as welcome here as a Comanche war party at a sodbuster barn raising. He's in Dodge. Somebody from the saloon where Billy was shot telegraphed Ben, and he talked me into coming here and saving Billy's hide if I can. I came in on the Union Pacific westbound.
Darnation, he was hit five times. He won't be able to move for maybe a week, and then he'll likely be moved to the jail. You aim to take him out on the train?
Yes, he'll be in no condition to ride.
I'm not fond of Billy Thompson, but I consider Ben a friend. I'll help you if I can.
You'd best keep your nose clean. I have a plan. And if that fails, I see no reason for you being hanged from the same limb as Billy and me.
Taking Bat's advice, Nathan didn't involve himself in the rescue. Instead, he went to the Union Pacific Terminal and learned that there was an eastbound every night at 11. It almost had to be the train that Masterson had in mind. Every night, half an hour before the train arrived, Nathan was in the shadows across the street from the hotel. 4 days after Masterson had reached town, the escape took place. At 10:30, a Surrey with curtains drawn rolled up before the hotel. A fusillade of gunfire ripped the night. Not surprisingly, the furor took place at the farthest point from the railroad terminal. Billy Thompson was lowered out a second-floor hotel window with a rope, and Masterson was waiting for him. The two of them entered the waiting Surrey.
My hat's off to you, Bad Masterson.
Then Nathan slipped away, returning to his room, where Empty waited. Dodge City, Kansas, July 1st, 1880. While Wes Tremaine had won the respect of all who knew him, his reputation as a fast gun had a dark side. Wes stepped down from the baggage coach.
Tremaine! I'm calling you out! Draw!
I don't know you, and I have no fight with you.
The hell you don't! I'm Ivan Curry! I'm faster than you! And you ain't gonna deny me the chance to prove it!
Wes waited for Curry to draw. His first shot was wide, and only then did Wes draw. Harley came running up.
Damn it, Wes! Never hold back when you know you have to fight. He could have killed you.
But he didn't. I didn't want to fight him.
Wes tried to live the story down, but the newspaper told of Wes Tremaine allowing Ivan Curry to shoot first and then killing him with a single shot. Wes Tremaine was forced to accept the terrible truth. As much as he appreciated his position with the railroad, the very nature of it was creating for him a deadly reputation as a killer. Supper at Delmonico's became a gala event, with Harley, Foster Hagerman, and Vic Irwin praising him. But when darkness crept over the land and distant stars became pools of silver in a purple meadow, Wes Tremaine reached a decision. Taking his few belongings, he saddled his horse and rode away. Nathan considered riding to Cheyenne, but thought better of it. While he didn't doubt Byron Silver's ability to undo the turbulent events that had resulted from their recent visit, he didn't believe in kicking sleeping dogs. He considered riding back to Dodge, but came up with two good reasons for avoiding it. Trouble stalked Ben and Billy Thompson like their shadows, and he had little doubt the unpredictable pair would be in Dodge. So he rode south toward Denver. He reined up. They were nearing the South Platte River when Empty came trotting back. There was somebody or something ahead of them. Nathan dropped to the ground. His Winchester in the crook of his arms, Nathan moved ahead. And the very instant he spotted his antagonist, the man saw him. Nathan cut loose with the Winchester. Only then did he see the girl who crouched in the underbrush.
Come on out. And if you have a gun, leave it there.
I don't have a gun. He robbed a bank and took me captive.
She crept out, and Nathan doubted she was more than 19. He also doubted she had been taken captive, for she was dressed for riding. Her boots, Levi's, and red checked shirt looked new. Nathan walked up to her.
He took you from the bank, I reckon.
Yes, I'm hurt. He kicked me in the belly.
She had unbuttoned her shirt near the belt line and almost caught Nathan off guard. He still held the Winchester, and he flung it as hard as he could. The muzzle of it struck her wrist, and she dropped the deadly little derringer.
Oh! Ah, damn you! You've broken my arm!
I'm ready to forget you're a woman and break your neck. Now you're going to talk and talk straight, or you'll be sorry you ever laid eyes on me.
You can't make me talk.
Maybe not, but I can make you wish you had. What's your name?
Kate McDowell.
Who's the man I shot?
Will Blackburn.
There was nobody else involved in the robbery?
There are four others. Will double-crossed him and took all the gold. They would have killed him. Now they will kill you.
Well, they can try. Now why don't you tell me where you fit into this?
I told you I was taken captive. Will wanted me to go with him, and when I refused, he took me anyway.
You're lying. You're not very good at it. I freed you from Blackburn, and you thanked me by trying to gut shoot me with a sleeve gun.
At least I knew, Will. I don't know you. For all I know, you're just another outlaw after the gold.
For a town woman taken against your will, it was mighty convenient you being all decked out in a man's shirt, Levi's, and boots. Explain that.
Will brought the clothes and made me change. Now are you satisfied?
No. I aim to have a look in Blackburn's saddlebags, but I reckon I'd better pull your fangs first. Get belly down. I'm going to tie your hands behind you.
Is that necessary? You took my gun.
All right, don't try anything foolish.
But no sooner had he turned toward Blackburn's horse than she sprang into the saddle of her own mount. Mounting Blackburn's horse with intentions of riding after her, he made an alarming discovery. The horse was lame, reason enough for Blackburn attempting to gun him down. Having lost Kate McDowell, if that had been her real name, he turned his attention back to the saddlebags the lame horse carried. But to his dismay, there was nothing but personal items, leading him to wonder if the elusive girl had told him the truth about the bank robbery. Seven horsemen approached, and the lead rider wore a lawman's star on the left lapel of his vest.
Lift them irons slow and easy, using your thumb and finger, and then let them drop.
Sheriff, don't I get a chance to tell you who I am and to explain why I'm not who you think I am?
That bay horse pretty well explains who you are. Now, where's the woman and the money?
Well, I don't have the answers you're looking for because I'm not the man you're looking for. Now, damn it, you're going to listen to me.
Then you keep your hand shoulder high and do some talking.
For starters, this is not my horse. You'll find my Gruya grazing down the river a ways. My name is Nathan Stone.
Quickly, Nathan explained what had happened and what the girl had told him and of her eventual escape.
Mister, do you have any proof you're who you claim to be?
Yes.
From the pocket of his shirt, he removed the pocket watch given him almost 10 years before by Byron Silver. He snapped open the case before passing it to the sheriff, revealing the great seal of the United States and the address of the Attorney General in Washington.
Why, hell, I know you. You was one of the hombres that busted up that land grab in Wyoming Territory. Who's in the Denver papers? I'm Sheriff Handy Green from Denver.
Sheriff, all I know about this is what the girl told me, so I don't know if it's true or not. She told me her name was Kate McDowell, and that she'd been taken captive by the man I shot. She said his name was Will Blackburn, and that he had robbed the Denver bank.
He robbed a bank, all right, but he wasn't alone. How was this woman dressed?
Like a man. Her hair was short, and her hat was down over her ears, like it was a mite big for her.
The second man might have been a woman. Which way did she ride out?
Upstream.
Damn it. Blackburn likely hid the loot when his horse went lame. We'll never recover the money unless we catch her. Let's ride.
The sheriff and his posse rode out at a fast gallop upriver.
Empty, we're in no hurry to get to Denver. I reckon we'll find us a place to hold up and wait a spell. I got a gut feeling me and that slippery little filly will meet again.
The sun was warm and Nathan dozed, unaware of the passage of time. Nathan was instantly awake. Just beyond the clearing, on the farthest bank, there was some movement in the brush. Kate McDowell stepped out, looked carefully all around, and then hurried downstream. On the opposite bank, keeping out of sight, Nathan followed. Eventually, she paused, looked around, and then dropped to her knees. Brushing away dead leaves, she began scooping handfuls of dirt from what had been a stump hole. Nathan crossed the river where there were sandbars and the water was shallow and saw the girl triumphantly lift a canvas bag from the hole. Only then did she notice Nathan standing a few feet away.
There's enough for us both. Come with me.
Thanks, but I reckon not. The sheriff and his posse will be returning directly and I'll be turning you and the money over to them. I owe you that for trying to kill me.
She ran back the way she had come, but Nathan was prepared for that. He had built a loop in his lariat, and he dropped it over her shoulders, pinning her arms. Hauling her up short, he slammed her to the ground on her backside.
Ow!
Save it. You can get up if you want, but the rope stays where it is. I'm within a gnat's eyelash of taking the other end of this rope and horsewhipping you. Open your mouth one more time, and I'll forget you're a female.
The sheriff and his posse returned an hour later.
She's all yours, Sheriff. I watched her dig up that canvas sack, and I reckon it's the missing bank money.
Sheriff Green opened the sack.
It's some money, all right.
I never saw that sack in my life. It's his word against mine.
Maybe not. There were witnesses who saw you in the bank. You know where a horse is, Stone?
I think so. I'll get it.
The horse had been tethered beyond the thicket from which the girl had emerged, and Nathan led the animal back to where Sheriff Green and the posse waited.
Wash, you and Tull double up on the ride back to town. We'll need an extra horse to carry Blackburn's remains. We're obliged for your help, Stone. It ain't often when they get away with a head start that we bring back the robbers and the money.
Denver, Colorado, July 3rd, 1880. After getting a hotel room for himself and Empty, Nathan left the room, bound for a saloon called the Casa Verde. The downstairs had a bar, a kitchen, tables for dining, some poker tables, and a roulette wheel. The upstairs was reserved for high-stakes gambling. It was as plush as ever, and the pretty girls moved from table to table, deftly avoiding groping hands. They still wore pink slippers, pink bows in their hair, and short pink jackets that covered only their shoulders and their arms to the elbow. Four of the nearly naked pretty girls worked the floor, but Melanie wasn't among them, so Nathan went directly to the bar. He got the attention of one of the three bartenders, and the man raised his eyebrows questioningly.
I'm looking for Melanie Gavin. She's a longtime friend. I last saw her 4 years ago when she was working here.
She no longer works here. She's part owner. I'll ask if she wishes to see you. Your name?
Nathan Stone.
The bartender stalked to the far end of the gambling hall and knocked on a door that had a glass pane in the upper half. The door opened just a little, allowing him to speak, and then it was closed.
She'll see you. Knock on that door.
Melanie opened the door. Her dark hair still cascaded to her shoulders, reminding him all the more of Molly Tremaine and that brief but stormy affair of 14 years ago. She wore a low-cut green gown that all but swept the floor.
Well, don't just stand there with your mouth hung open. Come on in.
Sorry, I wasn't sure it was you decked out in all that finery.
Make up your mind. Last time you jumped all over me because I was naked in a saloon.
I'm not sure I didn't like you better that way. Something's missing.
It was all there last time I looked. Do you expect me to stand naked in the same place for 4 years until you show up for another roll in the hay?
Well, I don't know what I expected, but not this. When I was here before, you said I was welcome any time, and I sure as hell don't see any welcome. As for the roll in the hay, I don't have to come to Denver for that. There are other women equipped just as well as you, but without your high-toned, prissy attitude.
He had his hand on the knob of the door when she took hold of his cartridge belt. He turned around, prepared for he knew not what, and she threw her arms around him and kissed him.
Melanie Gavin, I purely don't understand you.
I meant what I said about you being welcome. I just had the foolish idea I'd see you a little more often than once every 4 years.
Now, I've been to hell and back since I was here, and it was a long, hard ride. I see you put the time to better use than I did.
You said you'd prefer that I didn't prance around naked in a saloon, and I got to thinking about that. I saved every dollar I could, and 6 months ago I was able to buy a half interest in this place.
Who owns the other half?
Bella DiCarlo. She inherited it from her husband, Anton. He was shot last year after he was caught slick dealing.
He deserved it. Hell, the odds always favor the house. You don't have to cheat.
That's what Bella believes. We have a standing offer of $50 to anyone who can prove our house dealers are cheating.
That being the case, I reckon I'll set in on one of your high-stakes games. That'll give me plenty of time for a look at those naked women.
Look, but don't touch. Bella takes over at 9. If you're still around, you can escort me to my boarding house, and we'll talk about old times.
I'll be here, but if we get too deep in those old times, there'll be a lot more than just talk.
There better be, after a 4-year wait.
Nathan sat in on several games of 5-card stud and saw no evidence of cheating. He consistently won more than he lost, and by the time he and Melanie walked out into the evening air, he was ahead more than $300.
I've improved my living conditions.
They walked in the direction of her nearby boarding house.
I now have a kitchen and I can make breakfast in the morning.
It's tempting, but I've already rented a room and Empty's there.
Why don't we get the poor dog and bring him to my place? Then you can stay the night, and I promise I can feed you both better than any cafe.
Well, you've convinced me. With that kind of offer, we'll stay tomorrow night as well. I want some more of that high-stakes poker. Came out 300 ahead tonight.
Damn it, I share my bed with you, feed you, and then you take my money. All men are selfish brutes, taking advantage of women.
Usually with an almighty lot of cooperation from the women.
Indian Territory, July 5th, 1880. Leaving Mobidi, West Tremaine watched his back trail. Soon there would be a stage from Dodge bound for Fort Griffin, and West didn't wish to be recognized by the driver or the man riding shotgun. Having seen a map of the Southwest in Foster Hagerman's office, he rode eastward, knowing he would eventually reach Dallas or Fort Worth. He soon became aware of wagon tracks leading in the same general direction as he was riding. There were other tracks as well. 6 horsemen, 3 on each side, accompanied the wagon. The terrain became more rugged, and Wes wasn't surprised when he came upon the abandoned wagon. There were no teams, and apparently the occupants of the hapless wagon had mounted the mules or horses and had ridden away. But beyond the wagon, the man lay face down, the back of his homespun shirt a mass of blood. West knelt down and, seeking a pulse, found none. The man was dead, and from his broken shoes, West believed he had been at the reins of the animals drawing the wagon. That explained why the wagon had left the level plain and entered the dense woods. The mounted riders had taken it, probably at gunpoint. Had the dead man been alone, or had others, perhaps a woman with children, been taken captive by the killers? West Tremaine was faced with a dilemma. While this was none of his business, could he in good conscience ride away? Despite his hating to attend church, much of its teaching had remained with him, and he recalled the parable of the Good Samaritan. If innocent people were being held captive by thieves and killers, he could not, in good conscience, leave them to their fate. He checked his Winchester and then his Colt, thumbing a sixth shell into the empty chamber. He then rode cautiously on, unable to see more than an occasional track to assure him he hadn't lost the trail. Wes leaned forward, seizing the muzzle of his own mount before it could respond. He led his horse back the way he had come. There he tied it, hoping it wasn't close enough to betray him. He carried the Winchester in his left hand and kept his right hand near his thonged-down Colt. The camp, when he found it, was next to a spring, and as he had feared, there were two women captives. Wes decided they were probably mother and daughter, and they apparently hadn't been harmed yet. He moved closer but couldn't see all the men. He counted five. Where was the sixth?
Drop the rifle. And then, with finger and thumb, ease that Colt out and let it fall.
Denver, Colorado, July 5th, 1880. Nathan remained with Melanie Gavin two nights, and then, difficult as it was, managed to say goodbye. He rode on to the sheriff's office.
I'm ready to ride out, and I promise I'd talk to you first.
I'm obliged, but we won't be needing your testimony.
Yeah, what about the girl, Kate McDowell?
Oh, hell, I don't want to talk about it. With Will Blackburn dead and the bank's money recovered, the judge turned the girl loose. She lit out this morning, soon as I let her out of jail.
Well, maybe our luck will hold, and we'll never see her again.
Nathan rode south toward New Mexico. El Paso, as he recalled, would be something more than 500 miles. He had hopes that he might take up residence in some small New Mexican town, allowing him to slip into El Paso occasionally without having to fight the Sandlin gang. He reached the river early in the day as the sun bore down with a vengeance. It was hot, even for Colorado.
Empty. I'm going to pick at this horse, strip, and dunk myself in that old river.
Empty lit out downstream, and Nathan waded into the water. It wasn't even waist deep, and it was far from cold. He leaned over and ducked his head under the water and was wiping it from his eyes when he saw the girl. Kate McDowell had gathered up his hat, boots, and clothes and stood there grinning at him.
Damn you! Leave my clothes alone!
Make me!
But Nathan had an ace in the hole. Empty sprang at Kate, tumbling her down the bank and into the river. Nathan wasted no time getting to her, and she came after him like a spitting, clawing devil. Taking a wild swing, she drove her right fist into Nathan's nose. Stumbling backward, he fell and his head went under. Seizing his hair, she lifted his head clear of the water. He managed to get to his knees.
Damn it, why didn't you just go ahead and drown me?
You wouldn't have been much use to me, Dad.
By God, you've got more brass than a whorehouse bed. I don't aim to be of any use to you, alive or dead.
Ignoring her, he fished around in the water until he found his boots. Pouring the water from them, he threw them out onto the riverbank. His hat, trousers, and shirt were floating downstream, and he went after them. When he neared the riverbank, he couldn't believe his eyes. She had removed her boots and her shirt and was stepping out of her dripping Levi's.
Yeah, let's call a truce. At least until we dry out.
Too angry for words, Nathan just glared at her. He seized his sodden trousers, shook the clinging leaves and grass from them, and began getting dressed. West Tremaine was fully aware of his precarious position. Whatever else these six men were, they were obviously killers. He dropped his Winchester and slowly lifted his Colt from the holster and let it fall.
Now, walk straight ahead and don't do nothing foolish.
West walked into the outlaw camp and the five outlaws got to their feet.
Found this varmint spying on the camp. I would have shot him, but he don't look old enough to be the law.
Hell, Carlisle, he ain't old enough to shave. You should have looked around some. His mama may be out there looking for him.
The outlaw, who appeared to be the leader of the band, carried two colts in a tied-down Buscadera rig, with a third under his belt.
Moody, you and Carlisle tie his hands and feet until we decide what to do with him. Doak, you and Sellers, find his horse and backtrail him. He may not be alone.
He ain't no use to us, Pierce. Why not just shoot him and be done with it?
By God, I'm giving the orders.
One of the other outlaws, named Moody, joined Carlisle, and Wes soon had his hands bound behind him. Carlisle shoved him down on the ground near the two women, and then bound his ankles. He was left there with nothing to do but study the captive women. They had not been bound. One of them was no more than a girl, perhaps in her late teens. Her eyes were on Wes, while the older woman appeared not to see him. Her bonnet hung to one side, and the front of her dress had been ripped to the waist. Embarrassed, Wes tried to turn away, but he couldn't ignore the woman.
Ma'am, have either of you been hurt?
The distraught woman stared ahead, saying nothing.
They murdered my father right before our eyes. Mother fought them, and they beat her, humiliated her.
Did they?
No, but they... You can see what... They did, but something happened. She can't, won't talk, not even to me.
She's in shock. The mind kind of closes, shutting out the painful things we wish we'd never seen.
I didn't know what to do, what I should do.
Nothing. As long as it's light and they're watching. But we've got to escape or they'll kill us, and I don't aim for that to happen. I'm Wes Tremaine.
We're the Tuttles. My mother's name is Emily, and I'm Rebecca.
Rebecca, if they let us live until dark, if you can free my hands, I'll get us out of this.
Oh, if you only could. They have whiskey, and I heard them say they had plans for Mother and me.
I reckon they'll have to be close to drunk to do what they got in mind. Get me loose. Let me get my hands on a gun, and I'll see that you come to no harm.
I will. Oh, somehow I will.
Pierce walked up to him.
Well now, it's time he answered some questions. Who are you, kid, and why are you following us?
I'm Wes Tremaine, and I wasn't following you. I was riding this way when I found I was near your camp. I wanted to see where you were so I could pass you by and keep on riding.
Ha ha ha! This just ain't your day. You should have knowed when you seen that dead hombre you was getting in over your head. Now there ain't but one way to silence you permanent.
Carlisle, shut your mouth.
Wes didn't know what to make of the situation. Four of the outlaws mounted up and rode out, leaving Sellers and Carlisle in camp.
This could be our chance.
No talking!
The two outlaws fixed their eyes on their three captives, and Wes was forced to keep his silence lest he arouse their suspicions. Rebecca dared not attempt to free his hands as long as their captors watched them so closely. Then Wes had an idea.
Hey, I'm thirsty. Why don't you bring me some water?
Go to hell. You got your hands tied behind you, and I ain't about to hold the cup while you drink. I ain't your mama.
Tie my hands in front of me so I can hold the cup myself. Unless both of you are afraid I'll escape with you looking at me.
Carlisle, keep the mouthy bastard covered. I'll tie his hands in front long enough for him to wet his whistle.
Sellers loosed the rawhide thongs. Wes allowed his wrists to be bound in front of him, and Sellers brought him a tin cup of water. Wes made no move to drink the water until Sellers had backed away and joined Carlisle. He then raised the cup to his lips, pretending to drink, while spilling most of the water on his rawhide bonds. When the cup was empty, he set it down and rolled over on his side, his back to the outlaws.
Get up, Sellers, and tie his hands behind him. This was your idea.
He ain't going nowhere.
But Wes was working his wrists against the wet rawhide, and it began to give.
Sellers, you better tie that hombre's hands behind his back.
If Pierce comes back and finds him like that, he'll skin you.
I'm getting damn tired of Pierce ordering me around. You think this is the army and he got all the brass?
Wes managed to free his hands of the stretched rawhide. He moved like a striking rattler, seizing Sellers' legs and slamming him to the ground. Wes grabbed his revolver. He swung the weapon as hard as he could against the outlaw's head. Carlisle fired. Wes Tremaine raised his weapon. Wes was working frantically at the thongs that bound his ankles.
What can I do to help?
Try to get through to your mother. We have to make a run for it. You have only as long as it takes me to saddle the horses.
But she doesn't ride.
She's going to this once. Both of you will ride one horse, and it'll be up to you to see that she doesn't fall off. I'll have to be free to watch our back trail.
Sellers was beginning to stir, so using the thongs that had bound his own ankles, Wes tied the outlaw's hands behind his back. Quickly, Wes retrieved his own Colt and Winchester and saddled his horse. To his dismay, he found Emily Tuttle unchanged.
Leave her be. I'll saddle a horse, and when you're mounted, I'll lift her up. You'll have to hold her in place so she won't fall.
Rebecca Tuttle said nothing, but she was game. There were no tears, and she didn't seem afraid. When Wes had the horse saddled, he helped Rebecca to mount. He took Emily's arm. The woman fought him like a crazed animal. Having no choice, he knocked her unconscious.
Did you have to do that?
No, I could have left her to the outlaws. Help me get her a straddle of the horse. We may not have much time.
Neither of the women was dressed for riding, and their long skirts were hiked well above their knees.
Just hold her in place. I'll take the reins of the horse.
Wes led out, riding south. He believed the four outlaws had business in Mobidi, and he dared not ride in that direction lest he meet them returning. He quickly learned his fears were well-founded.
They're coming after us!
Here, take the reins of the horse and keep going. Maybe I can slow them down. I'll catch up to you.
Oh, please be careful. There are so many of them.
Maybe not for long.
Swiftly, Wes drew the Winchester from the saddle boot and led his horse into a concealing thicket. Just for a second, Pierce was visible.
Get him yourself! He's killed two men with two shots!
They were leaving. Wes couldn't believe his good fortune. Leading his horse, he continued in the direction the two women had gone. He came upon them, neither of whom was on the horse.
I tried to hold her, but she took to fighting me and slid off. I just couldn't get her back on the horse. She's too much for me.
Emily Tuttle lay on the ground, her voluminous skirt up to her armpits, her mad eyes on Wes.
It's like she's lost her mind. What are we gonna do?
I'm gonna tie her hands and feet and tote her belly down in front of me. Then we'll circle around and try to get back to Mobidi without another fight with what's left of that bunch of outlaws.
I heard the shooting. Did you?
I got two of them. The others may have given up on us.
That was the bravest thing I ever saw. How could I ever thank you?
You don't owe me any thanks. They were aiming to kill me, and I saved my own hide. We still have to get you and Miss Emily to the sheriff at Mobidi or to Fort Elliott. If nothing else, the army can see that you're taken back to...
Ohio. But we have nothing there. My father's family disowned him when he sold everything we owned to come west.
Your mother...
is an orphan. Her parents are dead, and I've never heard her speak of anyone else. I'm afraid she's lost her mind. What am I gonna do with her?
I don't know. You said your father sold out in Ohio. Didn't he leave you something?
Why do you think those men killed him? He had all our funds sent to the bank in Dodge City. We took the train that far, and after he closed out our account with the bank, he bought the wagon, teams, supplies.
The outlaws took your measure and followed you from there. If all this hadn't happened, where were you going?
South Texas. Father had dreams of owning a cattle ranch.
Emily Tuttle had calmed down, the madness having gone out of her eyes. They now seemed dull and uncaring.
Ma'am, you'll have to ride the horse.
No, Albert will bring the wagon.
My father's name was Albert.
Ma'am, Albert's dead.
No, no, no!
Ma'am, if you won't ride the horse, we'll have to leave you here alone.
While he was unable to explain to Rebecca what he had in mind, she quickly caught on and did her part. Wes helped her to mount the horse, and he then mounted his own. Not looking back, they rode away, quickly losing themselves in surrounding brush.
No! No! Don't leave me!
Wes reined up and dismounted. When the frightened woman reached them, he helped her up onto his horse. He then mounted behind her, and they began their roundabout journey back to Mobidi. Santa Fe, New Mexico, July 8, 1880. After leaving Kate on the banks of the river, Nathan found a room for the night and then went looking for a mercantile. There he bought several pair of Levi's, new shirts and socks, and a tin of grease. Thanks to the vengeful woman who threw his clothes into the river, his boots must be thoroughly greased lest they stiffen beyond endurance. Nathan sat on the hotel bed working the grease into the leather of the stiffened boots, while Empty sat near the window watching.
Oh, thank God you jumped her, old son. I believe she was about to ride away with my boots and clothes, leaving me Jaybird naked out there on the plains.
But the more he thought of Kate McDowell, the more of an enigma she became. For within his saddlebags, there'd been hundreds of dollars in double eagles. If she had really wanted to cause him grief, why hadn't she simply taken his horse, leaving him afoot and virtually broke? Of course, she hadn't known about the money. And if she had, Nathan was inclined to believe her interest was in him. He thought of her without the rough clothing and decided that with a bit of finery, she'd be an attractive woman.
Damn it, that's what she wanted me to think.
Nathan continued in silence until he had worked most of the grease into his boots, then stomped his feet into them and donned his hat.
Come on, pard. Let's get some town grub. Maybe a slap of apple pie will sweeten my disposition.
Nathan did feel better after eating, and he bought a copy of the town's twice-weekly newspaper and headed back to his room. The entire front page had been devoted to a single story, headlined The Lincoln County War. Nathan had heard of it and its most prominent participant, a young hellion known as Billy the Kid. Removing his hat, gun belt, and boots, he stretched out on the bed while Empty curled up on the throw rug. According to the newspaper, the war was actually a deeply rooted feud that had arisen from cattle rustling, rivalry over choice grazing, litigation over the settling of an estate, and the meddling of unscrupulous politicians seeking to use the Tunstall-McSween-Murphy feud for their own ends. Nathan read the story with interest, for he wondered how Billy the Kid, no more than a young boy, had come to play so prominent a part in the conflict. The violence had begun early in 1878 with the killing of John Tunstall, an English-born rancher. Unarmed, Tunstall had been gunned down by members of a deputy sheriff's posse. At least four known outlaws had ridden with the posse, and they had been more interested in killing the unarmed victim than enforcing the law. One of those with Tunstall when he had been shot had been the youth who had made himself a reputation as Billy the Kid. The kid, a slender, buck-toothed boy of about 18, had already been a fugitive from the law. He had hired on as a range hand and had been with Tunstall only a short time. Tunstall had given the kid a good horse, a saddle, and a new gun. Billy had been quick to learn and had been genuinely fond of his employer. As the newspaper pointed out, little was known of the kid's early life. The time and place of his birth were uncertain, and his original name appeared to have been Henry McCarty. The earliest record of his family had been the remarriage of his mother, Mrs. Catherine McCarty, to William Antrim. The wedding had taken place on March 1, 1873, at Santa Fe. The Antrims and the two McCarty boys, Henry and Joe, went to live in Silver City, New Mexico. But less than a year after her marriage, Mrs. Antrim died from a lung ailment. After her death, Henry, then known as the Kid, ran wild, and near Fort Grant, Pima County, Arizona, he shot and killed his first man. A coroner's jury called the shooting criminal and unjustifiable, forcing the Kid to skip the county. Reaching Lincoln County, New Mexico, the young gunman had assumed the name of William Bonney and had gone to work for John Tunstall. As the story unfolded, Nathan found himself more and more in sympathy with the boy known as William Bonney, alias Billy the Kid. After the murder of Tunstall, Billy had set out to take vengeance on the killers, who, having been in the sheriff's posse, had not been prosecuted. On the morning of April 1, 1878, Sheriff William Brady and his deputy George Hindman had been shot and killed in broad daylight while walking on the main street of Lincoln. Billy the Kid had been one of several accused of the crime, and Lincoln County had offered a reward of $200 for each of the killers. 3 days after the killing of the lawman, Andrew Roberts, a member of the posse that had killed Tunstall, rode into town. Hearing of the rewards, the heavily armed man had set out for Blazer's Mill, where he was told the killers of Brady and Hindman might be. As he neared the mill, he met a party of riders that included Billy the Kid. The men ordered Roberts to surrender, but he refused, and Charles Beaudry, one of Billy's companions, shot Roberts. Dying, Roberts shot three of his assailants. George Coe and John Middleton were wounded, while Richard Brewer, the young man who had been foreman on Tunstall's ranch, was killed. On April 18th, the grand jury indicted Beaudry, Billy the Kid, and several others for the killing of Andrew Roberts. The indictment also charged Billy and two others for the killing of Brady and Hindman. The following day, the Kid appeared in court and pleaded not guilty. Following his appearance, a minor revolution rocked Lincoln County, and not until April 14, 1879 did the Kid come to trial. Sheriff Brady had been a member of the Murphy faction, and following Murphy's death, the McSween followers had held an unauthorized election and installed a new sheriff sympathetic to their interests. But the Murphy bunch appealed to the governor of the territory, who appointed a Murphy man to the position. Returned to power, the Murphy faction set out to arrest Billy the Kid and crush the McSween group. The newly appointed Murphy sheriff and his posse, sided by hired gunmen brought in from other counties, found Billy in July 1878 with his McSween followers in Lincoln. The showdown came for the Murphy and the Tunstall McSween riders, who had been led by McSween since Tunstall's death.
My God, it beats all I ever heard.
But there was much more. After 2 days of ineffectual shooting in town, Billy and his friends had been driven into and trapped in the McSween residence. Late in the afternoon of the third day, July 19th, the Murphy posse set fire to one wing of the adobe house. As the fire crept toward them, the defenders blazed away with their guns while Mrs. McSween played the piano. During the fight, Deputy Sheriff Robert Beckwith of the Murphy clan was killed, and four of the embattled defenders, including McSween himself, met similar fates. As darkness settled over Lincoln, Billy the Kid ran from the house and escaped into the night. Later that night, the posse became part of a mob that broke into the Tunstall McSween store and robbed it of some $6,000 worth of goods. With both Tunstall and McSween dead, the Murphy faction was victorious, and Billy the Kid had become an outlaw on several murder charges. But news of the bloody vendetta reached Washington, and President Rutherford B. Hayes appointed General Lew Wallace as acting governor of New Mexico with instructions to bring peace. Wallace immediately issued an amnesty proclamation, and Billy, gun in hand, had met the general alone in a designated place. A reconciliation failed because two of Billy's deadly enemies, aided by Murphy sympathizers, had broken jail. Protecting himself, Billy the Kid rode away.
Damn them. I'll never let him out of it alive. He'll be murdered in the name of the law.
Acting Governor Wallace had appointed Odin Wilder as sheriff of Lincoln County, with authority to deputize as many men as he needed to arrest those who had participated in the feud. Every man so deputized would be paid $100 a month and provided with ammunition for Winchester and Colt. There was a hand-drawn map of Lincoln County, and Nathan was struck with its nearness to El Paso.
Empty? Sheriff Wilder needs some hombres in that posse that don't kill without cause. I reckon we'll ride down there and lend a hand for a while.
His horse carrying double, Wes Tremaine took his time. Thankfully, Rebecca Tuttle rode well, and Wes had only to concern himself with Emily. Hoping to avoid the remaining outlaws, Wes rode south for what he believed was 10 miles. He then veered west, and they soon were out of Indian territory. Rebecca trotted her horse abreast of his.
I'm glad we're back on the open plains. It seemed so gloomy and kind of forbidding back there, like something was waiting.
Indian territory. I heard a lot about it, but nothing good.
Little was said during the ride back to Mobetie, Texas. James McIntyre, the little town's new sheriff, listened attentively while Wes explained what had happened.
My God! You tangled with the Eck Pierce gang and killed Pierce?
He saved Mother and me.
Four of the bunch rode out. I reckoned they had business here.
They did. I rode over to Fort Elliott, and while I was there, they robbed a saloon and killed a man.
You didn't try to catch them?
Ma'am, besides me, there's 8 men in Mobeeti, and not one of them would follow me into Indian territory.
No help from the army, I reckon.
None. Half a dozen men with Winchesters could hole up down there in the territory and gun down a whole company of soldiers.
Sheriff, freeing these ladies from Pierce and his outlaws might have been the easy part. Mr. Tuttle is dead. They have no place to go, and Miss Emily is clean out of her head.
I fully agree with you, and it's more than I can handle. I suggest you ride to Fort Elliott and talk to the post commander, Captain Selman.
Wes could understand McIntyre's reluctance to become involved in the situation. It wouldn't be any easier for the post commander, but he wouldn't have much choice. They rode on to Fort Elliott, and Wes asked for a meeting with Captain Selman. The captain listened as Wes told him what had happened. He concluded with an explanation of Emily Tuttle's condition.
We have no facilities for treatment here. I can have the post doctor examine her.
How's that going to help?
I don't know if that will. I'm at as much a loss as you are, and I'm suggesting this because I don't know what else to do. There's a comfortable sofa in the next room. I'll send for the doctor.
Rebecca led Mrs. Tuttle into the adjoining room and had her lie down on the sofa. A table and chairs completed the furnishings. Hanging from a peg on the wall was a gun belt and holster, and within the holster was a revolver. Closing the door behind her, Rebecca returned to Captain Selman's office. Within a few minutes, Sergeant Dillard returned with the post doctor.
This is our post doctor, Lieutenant Carlton. Miss Tuttle, if you'll tell him...
Selman flung the door open. Emily Tuttle still lay on the sofa, but her face was gone. In a pool of blood on the floor lay the revolver. Trail of the Gunfighter, Autumn of the Gun is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1996, Ralph Compton, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2012, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Danny Gavigan, Tracy Oliveira, David Coyne, Eric Messner, Dylan Lynch, Joel David Santner, Drew Copas, Ken Jackson, Tim Carlin, Richard Rowan, Jeff Allen, Casey Platt, Bradley Smith, Kimberly Gilbert, Michael Glenn, James Konacek, Alyssa Wilmoth, Christopher Graybill, Scott McCormick, Christopher Sheeran, Lily Beacon, Nick DePinto, Elizabeth Jernigan, Gary Tells, Tony Nam, Joe Brack, Michael John Casey, Thomas Keegan, Joseph Thornhill, James Lewis, Nanette Savard, Barbara Pinellini, Bobby Aselford, Daniel Sontag, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Terrence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Book adapted for Graphic Audio by Johann Detweiler. Dialogue editing and Graphic Audio sound design by Patrick Stratton. With original music by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Ralph Compton's Trail of the Gunfighter, be sure to look for Elmer Kelton's Texas Rangers and Sons of Texas series, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, audio guides, and podcasts. Keep listening for previews of other thrilling titles in Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.